Hello.
Hey.
Here we go again. This is Biweekly Cast. This is episode number 28. It's 2-8. The hosts are here. It's you.
I'm Slava Rudnitsky. And you are?
And I'm Dima Malenko. And today we have a book club episode, and we are going to talk about the book, which is called No Rules Rules.
No rules rule. But before that, there should be a follow-up, is there?
There should be a follow-up, but we have none.
All right. Then we can jump straight to the book. Its subtitle is Netflix Culture of Innovation. And I think it's an ambitious title. So I think we could start with the question, why this book?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's good enough. I think you suggested that we read and discuss this book. So how come?
This is my third book club about this book, and I'm really excited about it because one of my colleagues in Savvy suggested that we discuss it in the managerial way, and this was actually, like, normally we run all company book clubs. Somebody suggests a book, and then everybody who wants comes, and it works like that. But this time, one of the managers initiated this thing and suggested that just managers read it and discuss it. And that was quite insightful. We got quite a few practices from the book, and I liked the way discussion went because we were actually able to try to fit this experience on Savvy Experience and compare some things and practices that we've had. It kind of goes hand by hand with our previous episode about transparency. And overall, I find that this book was both provocative and interesting. And I thought that we should discuss it. So as soon as I think I was maybe on one third of the book, and I knew that we should take it on the book club.
Right. Yeah, there was an interesting book. And I think that there was something in what you just said. Did you say that you read this book and discussed it with the manager circle, not with everyone in the company? I think that that's interesting. Maybe if I do not forget, I'll have some connections to that throughout the discussion. But I think that's very, very peculiar and interesting.
Fair enough. So shall we start with your overall impression?
Yes, let's try and do that.
Okay, is it like or dislike or neutral?
I think it's more like than anything else. I had a little bit of a roller coaster reading this book when it started. I was like, yeah, kind of, I get it, okay, it kind of makes sense. But then the towards chapters, I think 3 maybe 4, I got going, oh yep, I underestimated what's going on. But then after the peak, it also went down a little bit and went up in the end. So overall, this is a plus, but I guess to an extent, this is kind of a book that you would expect to get with this ambitious title, with these starry authors there. So it's good overall. Yeah. So after 2 book clubs for this book, what's your evaluation?
I would say that I was a bit agitated by this style from the very beginning because it was kind of messy. I started reading it, but then I switched to the audio format because the audio format was more consistent. I could hear where it was Reed's voice, where it was Erin's voice, where there was someone else's voice. It got kind of easier because the reading was a challenge. And then this feeling that somebody's, we could name it like Google or Amazon kind of books when they preach their style of management and doing things. Plus, I think I had quite an impression after reading first Netflix books by Pete McCord, and then there was the second one. I don't quite remember who the author was, but they just didn't go through, like they didn't pass. And I think this one is different because of Erin Mayer. She is the author of The Culture Map, which we discussed two book clubs ago or something.
Maybe some book clubs ago.
Yeah. In the previous book clubs, yep. We did discuss it.
And by the way, we on our site, biweeklycast.com, that there is a separate sections where you can find all of the book club episodes. And likewise, on YouTube, there is a separate playlist for book club episodes. So if you want to check out the books we discussed previously, yep, you're welcome.
It's new even for me. Has it been there for a while?
Yes, the book, what was the title, subtitle of the book? The Culture of Innovation or something like that? Yeah, that's what's going on.
Sure. So I believe we could go chapter by chapter to see how this book was unfolding. I would say that the general structure for people who haven't read the book is mm-hmm. that it's a conversation between the CEO of Netflix, Reed Hastings, and Erin Mayer, who is the culture expert, and she was kind of a researcher inside mm-hmm. the company who was trying to investigate what practices led to the results of the culture of innovation in Netflix. And I think that the book itself should be taken with a, let's say, a critical thinking approach. But generally, it's a nice piece of reading, and I think in one of your notes, you even kind of mapped out the overall layout of a chapter.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like the book consists of 10 chapters, and I felt like by fourth or fifth chapter, I felt like there is some sort of structure or pattern to how they kind of they structure those chapters where one of them, I thought that it would be Reed who first introduces some sort of anecdote on or story from the history of Netflix, then Erin would generalize and maybe back it up with some sort of research, and then they would discuss some more examples around that topic and round up and move to the next thing.
Mm-hmm. And they basically go through a number of things, but they were described in a chronological way, the way Netflix was introducing these things in their company. And I think we could start with the first chapter, which was mm-hmm. called First Build Up Talent Density. And the overall idea is that you want all of the top talents you can get. Mm-hmm. And the more talented people, the more average talented people, like what's the average talent score in your company, mm-hmm. the more foundation and ground there would be for the culture of innovations. I would summarize it somehow like that.
Right. I think, yep, that's the idea. And I think this was the first occasion where the kind of backing up it with research was kind of seemed dubious to me, because I think I cannot recall, was it Reed or Erin? I think it was Reed, right, who would introduce this idea that you want to build up talent density. And as they said in the book, and I think that this is one of the mottos they live by in Netflix, is average performance gets you generous severance or something along those lines, where they say that, hey, even like good average performance, we do not, well, we appreciate, but not enough, and we will let you go if you are not performing at the very best, I guess, of your ability and of the requirements or vision of the team. And then they use this bad apple effect research to kind of give some quote unquote scientific backing to this idea. And we know, like those who are with us for longer time would remember our discussions of bad apple effect and research and kind of challenges and dubious things around the research itself. So I felt like this backing was not great, but the idea nonetheless is very sound, right?
And that's the problem with this chapter, because on one hand, I like the idea of working with top talents, because it makes a lot of sense. I've heard a lot of variations of this, like A players and top mm-hmm. performers and many other titles, and it's intuitively a nice concept. But the way it was introduced in this book and the example that they used about the layoff that they had to make and then somehow the productivity didn't drop, even they had just a third or two-thirds of employees, was just not about it. There were so many things happening, and it would work very different in very different circumstances. And if a company, like a random company, cuts off or lays off 30% of the team, it might lead to very different circumstances and results and impact. And I don't think that that's a universal truth. And I agree with the idea of talent density. I like the concept itself that the more talented people you get, the more innovative they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the more you can do. And I totally agree with you that that example when they said that they had to go through those layoffs, to me that was a coincidental relationship between the two events, like no loss in productivity and a lot of people supposedly of lower performance let go. And I'm not sure if there is a universal causal relationship between the two.
Well, I would highlight one thing that I misread from the first attempt, and then somebody highlighted in one of the book clubs I've had about this book, that their actual conclusion was not about the performance, because at first I read it about performance as well. But then they mentioned that it is more about the atmosphere and the culture of innovation and collaboration rather than performance. Performance as well didn't really drop. But the idea was that the atmosphere kind of changed and people were more open to communicate, to collaborate, to suggest some things, to work on issues that they would ignore previously.
That's interesting. And I wonder, I don't remember if we discussed this book or what was that. There was also a film about the sort of famous trainer or manager of a US hockey team, I think, or something along those lines, where he explicitly and on purpose kind of antagonized the team to turn them into real teams so that they would be like, we the players are against this evil trainer, and he managed to turn them into this kind of sports machine, and they won either the Olympics or World Cup or something along those lines. And I wonder if similar effect can be going on here, where people who went through this by and large stressful situation of layoffs, and I don't remember what the year was that, and therefore of course cannot speak to the overall condition of the market at that time, and I can easily believe that it may be that the market was on a downswing and it might not be easy to find new job if you lose your current one. I guess that would prompt people to be more cooperative, do more, kind of invest more, maybe at the expense of some of their other activities or like family time or friends, just to make sure that they still have this job. And as I said, the causal relationship there is not proven, at least for me.
Fair enough. And what they suggest that after you build up talent density by cleansing the ranks of your employees and removing people who are at least average, and instead hiring people who are top performers, you are finally ready to move to the next stage, because you can't move to the next stage before you do that. And this is where I felt really awkward, because it felt like, how many companies did actually go this way? And you know that it would work for most companies that they should start with talent density and then move to next level, which is increase candor. Like, why can't you do both things at the same time? Why can't you hire people by the candor and feedback parameters? It was kind of messy. So the way that they were preaching this path of Netflix as the only possible way to do that, that this is the right order and sequence of things, was kind of messy. But the idea, again, is quite sound. I think that being sincere and open is an effective tool. We kind of discussed it in the transparency episode previously, but
right.
The funny thing is that in Erin Mayer's book, The Culture Map, she was actually referring to the United States as the culture of very indirect corrective feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Not very, very, but like direct people overall, but relationship with corrective feedback is very special. And the fact that Netflix managed to build this culture is impressive.
Right. And I think throughout the book they refer, I also kind of noticed that we, because in our previous conversations we referred to this kind of feedback where we point out on opportunities to do things better, we called it sort of corrective feedback. I think in the book they refer to it as developmental or something along those lines, developmental feedback. Yeah. Once again, I'm totally with you. The idea is very sound. Maybe some of the motivations and background there might even kind of undermine the legitimacy of the idea itself. I think for me personally, it would work just as fine, maybe even better, if they said, "This is what we did. It worked for us. This is why we think it worked. You should try doing this the same way," and rather than trying to provide some justification or scientific or otherwise different backing for this notion.
One of the things that was insightful for my colleagues was that the model that they were using was not based on linguistic models like most models are. Like when you think about feedback models, they normally say like something, tell about good thing, then criticize, then explain why it should happen, sandwich style, or
right.
Speak about impact, then behavior, then next steps, or something like that. And Netflix model is a bit different. They probably focus more on the attitude, that you should work with your emotional engagement, like you would like mm-hmm. to, you should be willing to assist, like aim mm-hmm. to assist. And that's probably the first precondition for feedback. If you don't right. have this feeling, maybe it's better not to. And
right.
that makes a lot of sense, especially when it comes to corrective or developmental feedback.
Right. I think that they referred to this model as four A's, and we may struggle a little bit to remember all four. First was, you've got the book maybe. The first one was indeed aim to assist, then was actionable, then something else, and then something
else. Aim to assist, actionable, it's the way you give it. And then mm-hmm. there were two things
right.
about receiving. It's appreciate
mm-hmm.
and then accept or discard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So basically mm-hmm. two things on the giving side and two things on acceptance side or not accept.
Right. And I guess that's a great description that you provided, like by separating the two. And I think setting the expectations on both sides this way would be something that would really help to kind of build this culture of providing feedback. Because if it might be difficult or challenging to decide or kind of to get courage to provide this feedback if you are not sure how it will be received. But if you can more or less rely on this feedback being appreciated, and then you give that other person the freedom to either accept or just disregard this feedback, it helps a lot.
A minute of statistics. Based on Savvy workshops, 49 out of 50 workshops on feedback are focusing on the way you provide or give feedback. And just mm-hmm. 1 out of 50 is actually about receiving and accepting or not accepting, like dealing with feedback that you get. So kudos for the companies who actually care about this second part, because I think it's a very important part of culture. And I personally struggle a lot with accepting feedback and sometimes even appreciating it. And I think it's a great point of growth for many managers.
Right. Same here. And I think those the first A in this acronym aim to assist or aim to help, whatever it is. I think when I get feedback and I get kind of cringy about it, what helps me is remembering something along those lines. And I start thinking that, hey, people did provide me this feedback not to humiliate me or something else along those lines, but they are genuinely trying to help, and let's process this from this point of view.
And it kind of works as a system, because when you know that people know about this model, mm-hmm. whenever they come with feedback, they aim to assist, it's easier to appreciate, because when people don't do that, then
right.
you're kind of supposed to appreciate anything people do, whatever they do, even if they don't aim to assist, and then it's getting counterintuitive and imbalanced.
Right. Well, I think that this would be a great first example of the idea I kind of took. I would not say I took this from the book, because I lived with this for quite a while, but I think that the book did relatively decent job of articulating that many of the things, in order for things to happen, oftentimes several different areas or different aspects have to work in concert. You cannot do just X. In order for X to work and be effective, you have to have X, Y, Z, A, B, C, and all of those things should kind of play a role in X being effective, and likewise in the rest of the stuff also being effective, would rely on X being in place.
That is fair. Do you think we can move to chapter 3?
Yep. Let's go for it.
This one is weird, because I think that the first two were conceptual, like get the best people, mm-hmm. work on feedback and candor, and then just remove vacation and travel policy or expense approvals, which is kind of narrow. And then mm-hmm. it later on evolves into chapters 5 and 6 about later stages. But for me, it's about the degree of freedom, or like the way of delegating things, the way of trusting your team. Mm-hmm. And that's really weird why people should start with a vacation and travel policy as the first thing, or the expense approval. It is weird to me. I think that the concept, like for instance, in Savvy, we don't actually have the vacation policy. And I think that people are adult enough to operate with their time. Plus, mm-hmm. we never really need this model, because most of our people used to be contractors.
Mm-hmm.
They could manage their time the way they wanted,
mm-hmm.
which was easy. But as I was listening to this chapter, it kind of irritated me a bit, saying that why is this exactly the first thing to do? Like, you work on big conceptual things, you get the best people, then you work on feedback and sincerity and the way people honestly share and escalate issues, and then you let them take vacations by yourself. Like, it seems like an action of a different order, mm-hmm. a different level of complexity. And it didn't feel like a chapter. It felt like a pre-chapter to the actual thing that you should do. Trust your team and let them do the job.
Interesting. You should say that. I have several thoughts on this chapter in particular. I think one would be a little bit of theory I developed towards the end of the book, where I thought that it started feeling to me as a little bit of a pyramid kind of thing, where the first three chapters, and I think they are grouped into parts or something along those lines in the book itself, were more of introductory kind of thing. And I think the first three chapters, including this one, were maybe a little bit more tied to that famous Netflix culture slide book. Deck. Mm-hmm. And it felt to me that some of those ideas on how to build talent density in more in greater specifics and how to increase candor and build a culture of feedback. They are discussed at greater detail later on. So maybe they use this just as an intro to this general idea of freedom, of building culture of freedom and responsibility. That's one thought I had. But indeed, it was kind of weird. But by this time in the book, after the first two chapters, I was like, yeah, okay, kind of it sort of makes sense. It felt to me like a book written with a whole bunch of survivor bias. Like we did this, it was successful, therefore to be successful you need to do this. And I expected that the rest of the book go pretty much the same, and I had some questions to the research backing it and so on and so forth. But I really liked it. I kind of glossed over the fact that indeed vacation policy and travel expenses are way too specific comparing to the previous levels of discussions. But in this chapter, I really liked the more detailed discussion of effects of such a change. And I think that one was really good, where they would look, oh, if you do this, then this happens, then that. And then in order to counteract or balance the stuff, you need to do X, Y, Z here and there. And it kind of provided the more or less holistic view on how freedom and responsibility culture might operate given the examples of vacation policy and travel and expenses policy.
It is fair. I could assume it's a build-up for something, but it just didn't feel right to me, because I think that some future things about like no decision making needed, or mm-hmm. these, what was the decision captains or informed captains?
Most informed captain, something like that.
Models, they seemed conceptual, like concepts mm-hmm. that you could actually discuss. And it felt to me that later, like by later chapters, when they started introducing, that's what you meant there, but kind of started with just a pre-story. Because basically I would expect that if it's a build-up, you would do the mm-hmm. same thing for chapters 1 and 2. You would just tell what were the preconditions for the talent density and preconditions for candor, and then later you will explain step by step how to implement it, mm-hmm. what are the side effects, what are the reactions of people, what are the possible resistance factors in the implementation, and how to overcome those. Overall, the structure kind of got hectic for me here, and I started losing the track of the book, which later smoothed and got better.
Interesting. One observation that I had regarding the structure of the book, which I didn't really appreciate, was that on several occasions, and I think maybe the next chapter that we are going to discuss would be one of the examples of that, where I would be listening to the book and I was like, no, folks, I kind of disagree with you, or you are omitting the fact that Netflix or businesses like Netflix have certain characteristics that allow for this idea to work. It would not work in different business with different dynamics or different cost structure or different revenue or kind of value generation structure. Like, yeah, you are not doing a great job here explaining this idea or exploring this idea. But then in later chapters, they will say that, oh, it only works because Netflix is in kind of creative sort of industry type of a situation, and therefore we are critically dependent on workforce being innovative and stuff like that. And like, dudes, like 3-4 chapters ago, you completely omitted this point in discussing very related thing, and this kind of rubbed me the wrong way throughout the book.
And chapter 4 was the place where I almost stopped reading, because I thought that this is purely Netflix context, that the idea that they introduced there that you should pay top of personal market.
Mm-hmm.
Was so weird. I would imagine that you just tell this anyone in Ukraine and say, like, just pay top of the personal market to your employees and you'll be fine. Like, when you are an investment-based company and you just get another round of millions of dollars mm-hmm. and then you can afford it, then yes. If you are a real, actual business and then you use this strategy, it's kind of... I'm not even speaking about the production or manufacturing or any other kind of things that work on very different models. Even the creative businesses in Ukraine. Let's take Sevi as an example.
Right.
The top personal market for the managers we could hire is approximately twice more expensive than our overall managerial budget. Like, we can't afford a single person with that cost. And we have to do what we have to do with the budgets we have. So for right. rich companies, it probably makes sense. But then when guys like, I don't know, Google tell that, guys, you should just be more open to the opportunities, give people more space and freedom. They are skilled enough. Yes, they are skilled enough in Google because you recruit them with like 7 levels of interviews and you get the top performers on the market. Then yes, you don't have to spend that much time for internal training. But all other tech-related companies, they get different sort of people. And this is where I almost stopped reading.
I didn't look at this way. I had my quirks with this chapter from kind of different perspective. But what you say kind of makes a lot of sense. And it just now occurred to me that kind of this very straightforward application of the idea that you would pay a person on a position kind of at the top of what's the market for that position kind of thing. It only sort of works when the market is more or less stable and sort of developed, right? When there is the variation there is not huge, because even in the US, yes, there is, and in other countries like UK, imagine that there is variation between salaries, wages for, let's say, even software engineers in kind of top five, like Fang, or however we call them, like Facebook, it's not Facebook, Amazon, Google, that kind of thing, and other companies that who also employ software engineers, like banks, financial institutions, and whatnot. There is, of course, those top tech companies pay higher salaries, but they're not vastly out of whack with the rest of the market. They are at the top percentile of the market, but the spread there is not huge, and this would only be feasible or kind of functional in the long term when there is this stability in the market is more or less settled and stable around those positions. And in Ukraine, even for software engineers, my understanding is that the market is very diverse and it can be anything. And I think in the book itself, they also had an example with someone having a very specialized sort of position for which the market is not hugely developed and it is difficult to measure. And they kind of tasked the person itself to with proving, with identifying and proving their market value, which is not bad in and of itself, but it's, I guess, shows that it might not be easy even to practice this idea of paying the top personal market, because it might be difficult to figure out what's the market, what's the top of that market, let alone pay at that rate.
I just can't imagine an alternative business model apart from huge investment that would work here, because let's say I'm building a little tiny ed tech startup. And I would need a product owner, a software engineer, and a QA, maybe a designer, like 4 people. Considering that Ukrainian market is overheated, including gambling companies that pay like 25-30% more than outsourcing companies in Ukraine. And then there are some specific product companies that also pay like really high rates. And they are in on the market research. Like if you come to Dough, you can say that, well, you know, an average QA gets from $500 to $7,000. Like, all right, that's quite a range. And if I have to pay top of the market, I would definitely need certain fundamental investment to build at least something small. And it's really hard to imagine how one would do that.
Right. I agree with that. And that all kind of comes to the vagueness of personal market, right? Because it can be that for this kind of position in this kind of industry, in this type of company, the market is something more narrow than what, for example, Dough shows. Because I would imagine, I don't know this for a fact, but I would imagine that maybe companies that which are in online or in gambling kind of business might offer somewhat higher salary to compensate for some of the other quirks which come with working in that particular industry, which might be required for people to kind of overcome some of their barriers. And you might kind of the market, the actual target market for the position in a more conventional company might be smaller, and therefore the ranges there might be smaller. But I think that the whole idea still holds. It might not be easy to follow this rule. And what I wanted to say something I remembered now. Sorry. The one positive thing from this rule, if you find a way to practice it, I think it can have a tendency to make managers also more responsible for what their teams are doing. Because if you are paying top buck for some position and you are not getting the performance you would expect at that level, it is, I would imagine, and kind of projecting this onto myself, it would be a bit easier to make more radical decisions about maybe firing someone if they do not deliver what we expect. Whereas at average or lower bound, it may be, yeah, we are not getting much, but we are not paying much either. Well, maybe it would be fine. If you are forced to operate at the top, it might make it easier to make certain kinds of decisions.
Maybe it's just hard for me because this is the mentality that kind of irritated me, especially when I talked about it with managers from rich companies. The way they make decisions, the way they operate with things. I think that this sort of logic appears when you don't make all the money that you spend, when you basically get the money from investors and then you decide how to reallocate these resources. And it's hard for me as an entrepreneur and a person who just was generating this revenue from scratch to think like,
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I remember back in 2017, 15, 16 time frame, I made a presentation in one of the IT conferences, and like it was about IT business in general. And one of the things and on one of the slides that I had that was along the lines of, there are in Ukraine, there are many outsourcing companies, right? And some of them are public companies which are trading on in US. So therefore, the data for their financials is available. And with very straightforward calculations, like getting their yearly or annual revenue and the headcount, you can get kind of average revenue generated by person. Of course, not all of them are engineers and yada yada yada, but in general, if I remember correctly, for that time, the order of there was kind of multiple orders of magnitude difference between outsourcing companies in Ukraine, where at average, on average per employee, they generated something along 70,000 per year, I want to say. I'm not sure. I may need to double check. And companies like Google and such, where the number, the revenue per employee generated was in millions, in like $2-3 million. And of course, it makes difference, you know.
It does indeed.
Those kind of numbers.
Anything else about top of personal market before we move on to the next
one?
Well,
a very quick remark. I think Reed used this idea of 10x developer, and I'm sure that especially developers or engineers of older generation, I'm not sure how popular this idea is now, but it used to be very popular that there is order of magnitude difference between the best engineers and not the best engineers.
And the rest engineers.
And the rest engineers. And Reed used this as a justification for kind of building up talent density and paying a top of personal market. Kind of this was a justification for that. Like you want to pay more because you get way more if you get top people. And like two quick comments from me. So there was one interesting quirk in how Reed introduced this research and the results of that research, where they said that when they set out with this some sort of experiment conducted in 70s, like think about this for a minute, but as people still keep referring to it, when they set out to do that sort of experiment, they expected 2-3x difference from best to average. But lo and behold, when they look at the results, they saw that there is 10x difference from best to worst. And I'm like thinking, what you just said kind of does not exclude the possibility that there was, and they expected 2-3x difference with the average. I get it, between the best and the worst, it may be 10x, but what's the difference between the best and the average? And he didn't talk, obviously he didn't talk about that, but all in all, this 10x developer idea has a lot of lore around it, and the origins and the exact data that suggests that is a bit murky. We will link to one of the articles that tried to research this topic a little bit. Whew. So, do we open the books now? Chapter 5?
And I should say that starting this chapter 5, it went really easy for me. Like, I was more into the book. I really liked the examples and the stories. And before chapter 4, I was on the edge of quitting. Mm-hmm. But starting from here, it got easier. I think open the books is the easiest one, because the concept there is that you should be as transparent as possible, discussing all the financial situation, revenue flows, biggest financial decisions and priorities with the team. And I think we can just refer to our previous episode, because we did a lot of discussion mm-hmm. about that just a few weeks ago.
Right. Yep. Makes a lot of sense. And then there, I think Reed and Erin made an argument that yes, transparency can cost you, that there are risks associated with it, but at least for the company that strives to be innovative and critically depends on people doing quote-unquote the right thing, it helps a lot to be transparent for people to get as much information for their decision-making as they can. It, on average, that works.
Right. And then chapter 6 was about no decision-making approvals needed. And there were plenty of examples of how people are surprised when they don't have to approve things after mm-hmm. working for some bureaucratic systems and needing 10 approves on a single decision of mm-hmm. office supplies or something else. And right. It also makes a lot of sense to me, but I've been having this issue starting from this article and then later with chapter 9, Lead with Context, mm-hmm. I thought like, how does it actually impact Netflix? And I went to look for their stock market prices. And mm-hmm. it turned out that just a few years ago, it dropped significantly because they didn't manage to synchronize their efforts and they spent a lot and they didn't get the amount of new users that they expected. And mm-hmm. I think they dropped something like 60%, which is mm-hmm. huge for a public company.
60, of course.
Chances are they will survive, but the overall idea that this is the best decision-making model, given the fact that this strategy failed a few years ago and the trust that they put on the informed captains was not actually paying off, kind of made me hesitant again here. I thought like, no decision-making approvals, all right, but then there should be a culture of monitoring and looking through the books and discussing these things and being transparent, not just on individual level, like when your peers do something or when you see that your subordinates do something or your manager does something and you call it up, but some more dashboardy kind of thing to see the bigger things, because I can easily imagine how people go over budget because they don't have any decision-making approvals and they spend more than the company has on the accounts and create an issue.
Right. I think that chapter was okay for me, because in my notes I put that this is the first time they admitted that Netflix's business is somewhat, not to say unusual, but it has its specifics which make it different from other businesses, and things may not work as well in those other businesses. And I think one more thing that I put in my notes towards the later chapters, and this is where I started disagreeing with them, but I think in the very last pages or last minutes of the book, they also kind of corrected that different parts of the company may operate differently and different rules and driving forces and dynamics might be applicable to them. And I can totally see how the entertainment and content creation part of Netflix's business is more like venture capital type of business, where you don't want to miss investment in that particular thing or film or series or whatever it is that is going to be huge, and it will kind of carry on with it or compensate for all of those unfortunate investments that you make in those other less successful films. So like there, the mode of success would be not to miss that one thing, rather than minimize the losses on the rest of the stuff, because the difference in payouts are so vastly different. You just want to get this one thing at any cost. And at the same time, other parts of the business, and I think there they had an example where Reed made this decision to split CD delivery business and streaming into separate subscriptions, requiring people to kind of pay twice or something like that if they wanted to keep what they had previously. That caused their price, stock price, to tank with all the negative effects, and that was kind of admittedly different kind of decision, and different process may be better followed there. And I think that it missed, I missed this from this part, although the overall discussion there, I think, was more or less sound if you keep Netflix's specific in mind.
And after that chapter, they introduced the Keeper test, which is quite an unusual way to look at the way you retain talents. The overall idea is that both an employee and a manager should ask a question: would I fight hard to keep this person on my team? Or would my manager fight hard to keep me on the team? If the answer is yes, you should just chill and do what you're doing. If the answer is then maybe you should ask for feedback and deal with it and improve your performance somehow. The concept is nice. I really enjoy the fact that they introduced different points of view here, because it seems to me that Reed really enjoys this idea, because it's not like rank stacking, and it's kind of a unique thing for Netflix. And I really like the idea that Erin introduced there, that for some people, the keeper's test is actually very stressful. And going through these questions, and it could be humiliation, it could be scary, especially when you don't get the right answer, it kind of throws you down and your productivity drops, and you may actually perform worse after going through the keeper's test than you would if you were not that, you know, eager to know.
Right. With this chapter, I also kind of like one of the key ideas I sort of liked about this, and I guess the previous chapter where they introduced that we removed, like, circling back all the way to travel expenses and vacation policy and other sorts of approvals. They said that they just we replace very specific rules of, like, the amounts for approvals and stuff like that with a very coarse generic rule, do what's best in Netflix interests or something along those lines. And here they also replace maybe more specific ways of assessing person's performance with just more vague and coarse, like, would the manager fight to keep you if you are moving to a similar position in a different company. I think, like, to an extent, this whole idea of having more coarse rules is something that can enable good things to happen. Like, it would, by being less strict, it would not prevent good things from occurring, hopefully providing sufficient guardrails to guard against bad things from happening. And that I kind of like. I also feel like sometimes you can be overly specific with the rule, and it just does more harm than good with that kind of rule. On the keeper's test, I also felt in their discussion they were a lot harsher on negative effects of stack ranking and similar kind of practices comparing to the negative effects of the keeper test. I think they overplayed negative effects of those things, not mentioning any positives, like having a more formal system that's hopefully easier to understand for people. Instead of relying on the whim of a manager, one single person, you can be more uniform across the company, and so on and so forth. They didn't talk about that at all. And the downsides of keeper test, they said, some people might be a bit more nervous, but when they talk to a manager, it should be fine. And there I was, like, super surprised by this specific example where that they gave an example of an engineer who was doing great, and they asked their manager, like, would you fight to keep me? They said that yes, of course, no to two opinions about that. But then the next year, the manager was a little bit more hesitant, and that sent an important signal to that employee. They started changing their behavior, and then in 6 months, they asked that question ahead of time to check in with how things are going. I'm like, what the hell? Like, are you giving person actionable feedback once a year? What's going on there? I think I felt like this particular example played against the whole idea of actionable feedback and improvement, and I didn't feel like this is the way how to minimize downside effects of this subjective keeper's test.
So true. And I think that the idea of no rules rule, the concept itself, yeah, that you minimize the procedures and you basically give a few conceptual levels that people operate mm-hmm. with is will be kind of described later in chapter 9 about leading with context, and I think they kind of correlate with this thing. But the keeper's test is weird, I agree. And then chapter 8 is just amazing, because the circle of feedback is the practice that I would definitely like to try, and mm-hmm. maybe in a few different variations, not just in my team, but overall. It's a mix of a peer-to-peer group and the way people discuss difficult things. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very complicated thing to do in the US environment, And I was really impressed that Netflix managed to build that up. I think it would work easier in more straightforward cultures, let's say Dutch. Mm-hmm. Like I can totally see people doing that. But back in the US, people who managed to build it up, applause and respect.
Interesting. I was a bit puzzled by the book, even though kind of generally I agree with the recommendations they give, and kind of I feel like this is a very great idea to have this 360 kind of feedback and get feedback from all kinds of, get feedback from the manager, get feedback from peers, and also get feedback from people who report to you if you happen to be a manager. I think that makes a lot of sense, and I really like the formula or format for giving pieces of feedback where you would either suggest that someone starts doing something or stops doing something or continues doing what they're doing. I think that's a great way to frame and see what to say to that other person and kind of naturally balance negative or corrective feedback with encouraging and supportive feedback. What puzzled me is that I thought that the regular 360 feedback is what it is. Like this is the 360 feedback, but in the way they introduced this in this chapter, it was that, well, the industry does this 360 feedback this way, but we invented so much better way of doing feedback for Netflix, and this is what, like, basically everyone should start doing this. And I didn't find there anything that would be so drastically different from what I known to be a 360 feedback, maybe except for that live kind of thing, but all the rest.
I think the live thing makes all the difference, because when people can hear what other people think about it, I think it makes all the difference. Because when you work with questionnaires and forms, you basically don't, somebody gets to operate with all this information later on, either a manager or a person who gets the feedback or an HR or someone else. Mm-hmm. But in this case, when it's public, it kind of reinforces the culture of candor that they were discussing previously. Because if it's okay to do it, people appreciate it, people practice it, and then you can also kind of get more context of what other people feel about something. Because let me give you an example from our team. One would have amazing relationship with the team. Like, mm-hmm. Manager is doing great. The team loves the manager supports the team. And then the manager has very difficult relationship with peers, like, mm-hmm. and other managers in the same lane. Very complicated, right. Like not much trust and issues. And then very good relationship with the person this manager reports to. So when all right. these people come together in the same room, they can see that things are different for different people, that this person is not just great or terrible, that the peers can see that he's actually doing great with his team and with his manager or her manager. And the team can see that, oh, all right, there are some issues with other managers in the line. So it kind of provides more context what this person is, and it gives more context to this manager, because normally when you look at these separate, I don't know, charts or questionnaires or something, I think it's not that effective, at least the way I see feedback 360 in most IT companies.
Interesting. I would imagine that, like, still with 360, a manager of a person would see feedback that was provided by the peers for that person, right? They would see that something is not.
Yeah, but clicking there, mostly people use the standard 10 scale grade, like how effective is this person, how happy you are, how punctual, how something. And people go through this standard 8 to 9 points that they rate a person. Right. And then maybe if they are actually open, they would write something in the follow-up question, like, what do you think this person could improve? And this is the only actionable part of this thing. The rest is really, really useless.
Hmm. Makes sense. I think that might be the difference between my perception of 360 versus canonical perception of 360. I now started to vaguely remember that indeed that there is a questionnaire with this kind of things that you do put kind of marks or something along those lines. I think in my practicing of 360, never do that. We only did the like a free form writing type of thing with different formats, but without all that minutia of weird stuff like punctual. Like, you serious? All right. Interesting. But that was also one the chapter where I started thinking that maybe this is more a book about building culture for top and middle managers rather than the whole company. And this is why I found it curious that you discuss this theme with this book with your managers. And I think in the next chapter, which is lead with context, is even more applicable to kind of this top to middle manager kind of flyer in the company. Do we want to go there now?
Yeah, sure.
So what they say there is that you lead with context. Case right. Closed.
Agree.
No control, just context. Yeah. Well, the idea would be that instead of trying to directly tell or micro sort of manage or directly manage people by telling them to do X, Y, Z, you tell them, oh, like ABC is important, that this is the priority for the company or something like that. You build the context and let people decide for themselves what makes the best sense given the context you provided to them. Is that a fair summary?
There was one thing that kind of feels awkward. Like, yes, in case you lead with context, which probably means that you don't make decisions for your team. You let them make the decisions and take the responsibility for it. And then when you provide the context and somebody makes a mistake or makes a series of wrong decisions that later lead to losses for the company, and then you fire this person because back in, I don't remember which chapter, but they were discussing that they do fire more people on average than an average company, which is not critical more, but they do have to fire. And then all this candor feedback that people get after making the mistake. How do you actually understand whether you as a manager provided enough context for this sufficient decision making? Whether the responsibility is actually yours for not sharing something that was crucial in the process of the decision making, or the responsibility is the person's who was making the call and approving the decision.
Right. Yep. Totally agree with that. I think that is the piece that I felt missing throughout many chapters in this book, where they would introduce an idea like here, leading with context, and they would provide examples that show how this particular idea works. And oftentimes they did not connect that to those other principles that they introduce in this book. Like, because like here, as you described, with whatever it is, like radical candor or whatever candor they promote, we would expect the manager, and I think in some early examples they gave, they would expect that manager to come forward and say that, hey, mea culpa, that was my fault, I didn't provide enough context or something like that. But they do not talk about that here. And this is kind of weird.
It is. But generally speaking, when you think about different levels of delegating and that you basically can delegate a task, a specific instruction to find a solution and improve it, or just to find the solution without any approvals, it makes sense because it's correlated with the level of maturity of the team. And technically, if you have the high talent density and if people are open and sincere and they communicate with each other, then it should work. And then I kind of refer back to this stock price drop that was caused by the managers and the lack of sync, because when you are supposed to share the context and you rely on a number of people on different markets from different cultures who understand this context differently, this is where communication becomes an issue. And I think this is one of the last articles, chapters about the cross-cultural aspects, which is very generic, but I think it kind of, it's still in the process of shaping, like how do you actually adapt this thing when the company goes global? Because when it's a few hundred people and everyone knows each other and there are clear areas of responsibility, it kind of works one way. But when these guys start operating huge budgets and they have to run some things together, like to create campaigns, to choose the, to set the priorities that would impact markets and teams and departments, and then set the right context lower, I think that this chapter was the least instrumental. Like on the feedback thing, they told the concept about the candor, they gave these four A's, then they provide the circle of feedback. It's some things that you could try. On the decision-making freedom, they say like, well, that's the keeper's test, that's the open the books section, no vacation policies, things like these are the things you could do. About leading with context, I didn't quite understand what actually managers have to do to lead with context. Is it regular practice? Is it the way you run your one-to-one meetings? Is it the way you make decisions and set goals for the team, for the project, for something? It kind of lacked the instrumental thing. It was very philosophical. And this is where I think that it was a bit out of context of the entire book, because previously most of the ideas they introduced were instrumental.
That makes sense. I can see it that way. And this is one of the reasons why I started thinking that this is, especially towards the later chapters, it's more of a book for managers, for the managerial kind of part of the company. And I agree with you that there are, indeed, there are almost no instruments that they give in this chapter, except maybe when Reed mentioned that he practices leading with context through their quarterly business review meetings and something else on the same scale. And there he explicitly said that the first thing, which I don't remember now, it kind of covers a top 15% of the company hierarchy, and QBR covers top 10% of company hierarchy. Those was the extent of the practicality that they've given there. But I still think that the overall idea is sort of sound if you kind of take it and try to find ways for managers to operate, because the higher you get in the managerial hierarchy, the less opportunity, the less practical and less efficient it is to manage directly by setting given tasks and stuff like that. You ought to start setting the directions, goalposts, and those north stars, and communicate and socialize them with people through different means. And I think this is a very kind of sound idea. That's probably the only way for managers at the top to be more or less, well, hopefully more effective in their positions. But I do agree that there were no specific instruments given to practice that, and practicing that on the lower level might be a bit challenging, because it may be that there is an agreement between two teams that they build different parts of the system. There is an interface, they decided on the interface, and we have to do what the interface says. You do not have creative freedom to implement that interface differently, because other team depends on that. And there you get into specific tasks that need to be done a very specific way, even though the North Star is maybe something more generic or general and sets the context.
Even more than somebody comes with 4A feedback and says like, well, here is the actionable feedback you should correct. Leading with context kind of changes.
right.
And I think chapter 10 was even more philosophical. mm-hmm. saying like, well, it's all good, but adapt if you go to different places and work with different cultures, which is, again, fair advice, but it doesn't really explain how Netflix does that. Like right. what exactly they change in their culture when it comes to different regions and different... The only thing was probably about the recruitment. They were trying to find people who would match their culture even in different regions.
Right.
And that's pretty much it.
And this was also the chapter where I missed connection to other principles, where they, in some of the examples with, I think, Japan or maybe Netherlands, where the culture is completely different and the way how people give and receive feedback is different. And as we all know, giving, well, especially giving feedback is a vital part of managers' responsibilities. And they, in some of the examples, they went to great length to kind of educate and teach those managers Netflix's way of providing feedback. And there I started thinking, how does this connect to the keeper's test and talent density, where there we said like if someone cannot perform, we kind of let them go. But here we clearly say that they cannot perform or perform things differently than we expect them, but then we provide trainings for them. Like how do those two things connect? And this was one more example of how the ideas in the book seem to be introduced in isolation. And I would really, really appreciate kind of more holistic view and discussion of how they act together, because I'm sure they do, and maybe there are great synergies between those things, especially at Netflix. But I would love to learn more about that.
That is true. And this chapter kind of felt as if they wanted just to give Erin Mayer some space to show her expertise on cross-cultural management, and it was like a minute of advertisement, a bit where she was going into some concepts and describing high and low context cultures and all the other things that she did quite well in the culture map.
Oh, and that could also be a kind of a genuine struggle that they had in Netflix when they started the international expansion and was struggling with it. So it's only natural that they hired an expert in the field to help them sort that out and write a book about this stuff.
So summarizing all the 10 chapters, would you recommend reading this book?
Yes, I think I would recommend reading this book. And as always, I would recommend reading this book and then thinking about what you've read and what are the ideas and how to apply them to your situation. Like, never try to blindly apply whatever the book says.
What's your main takeaway, like the core message that you take out?
I think I'm not sure if this is the message I take from the book, but maybe this would be the two or three things that I reiterated for myself after reading this book. First would be the idea that the course rules can be more effective than kind of very specific rules, but you need to organize them kind of carefully and then with right people on in right circumstances. They can create efficiencies that are difficult or even impossible to create with like super precise and specific rules. That's one thing. Second thing would be about kind of systematic and holistic view on the processes and systems, where you cannot, it's impractical and ineffective to look at just one single thing. You need to understand how it connects to others and kind of manipulate them more or less all at the same time to make sure that the system will be moving in the right direction. That's the second. And the third, that would not be what you expect to hear. But I think like this book also repeated at least two or three ideas that we discussed in our points events earlier on. And I was pleased to learn to see that people on the other side of the pond also think in accordance to best thinking on our side as hosts of points, series of events?
Well, answering the same two questions, I wouldn't recommend reading this book. I would recommend listening to this book. I think reading this book is a waste.
That's a good point.
And I have a takeaway, or the takeaway, I don't know, one takeaway. And that would be that while designing a change in company culture, any change, basically, I personally should take more time considering the impact on other parts. Like, let's say I decide to introduce a new feedback rule or a managerial rule or a policy on communication with clients or something else. After reading this book, I will definitely spend more time discussing it with people and seeing how it impacts other sections where it's not directly involved, or that systems are complex. And that changing some things here may cause changes across the entire system, and smart risk management and consideration of the impact should definitely be done way more thoroughly than I would normally do that. So it's like a public promise that for the common changes in Savvy, I'm going to do that more thoughtfully.
Yep, that's golden. Great takeaway.
One, but very,
very important one.
Well, that's it for the book club, I guess.
Right. We went a little bit longer this time, but it was worth it. I think that was a great, great discussion. So in the end, you know, systems are complex, and therefore we wish all of you have a good week or weeks.
It depends, a week or weeks.